This show is not for the easily offended, so if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome back, Indie Comic Book Noise fans. It's Indie Comic Book Noise episode 423. Don't believe the rumors of a secret episode 423. That was attempted but failed. This is the real 423, except no substitutes. Indie Comic Book Noise is a podcast about independent comic books. This can include anything from the big two that has an independent tie-in. But more specifically, we talk about comics from Image and Boom and self-published books. We have a rotating cast of characters behind the microphones. This time we're running a little low on a vacation episode. It's just me, Andy, and Super Steve from the bunker.
Yep, it's the United States contingent. We've not told the Canadians that we're recording tonight. No, yeah. That's not true.
Phil is having some internet issues, which was provided some behind-the-scenes humor, but likely unlistenable audio.
And between you and me, Kevin's always got issues. Hey, now!
And Kevin is in a death battle with the Wendigo. So, you know, we're hoping his mutant healing powers have kicked in. We are part of the Deliberate Noise Network. That's put together by the awesome Derek Coward, who has his own show. And actually, probably has more than one show currently. I mainly listen to his main show, Comic Book Noise. But I know at various points he's done all kind of like a wrestling show. And
I was going to say at one time he had all the shows.
But he's gracious enough to farm these things out to different people.
That he is.
And you may hear us on one of the sister shows, Marvel Noise, run by Super Steve, a more professional outfit than us rogue indie people carrying on however we want to carry on. Making our own rules, but breaking it down one step at a time.
Sponsored by nobody, just the way we like it.
We have a Twitter handle, Indie Comic Book N, individual Twitter handles, Facebook page. The old episodes are at indiecomicbooknoise.com. We also put show notes and things there, so sometimes if there's links to, we'll reference someone's store, website, or Twitter handle. Sometimes I try and keep pretty good notes on that stuff.
Yeah, that's good of us to do.
So, we run a loose ship. So generally we just sort of round table whatever topics are up top of our heads. And this is our vacation filler episode, possibly. Steve and I right now are enjoying tropical drinks in randomly different locations, thousands of miles apart.
Although, if the stars align, we are going to cross paths physically for a day, even though we're vacationing in different places. That's pretty cool. That's the magic of comics, Andrew, right there.
We're going to cross on the astral plane.
The cosmic wheel.
So, Steve, I dialed you up because you said you had some independent comics that you wanted to talk about.
Well, last episode we talked like the whole episode about cons pretty much, which we love to do. Talk about our times, our experiences, the things we did, didn't do, saw, guffawed at, etc. But we didn't talk too much comics straight up about like what we were reading. So here we go. I finally have been catching up on like the Mignolaverse, the Hellboy books from Dark Horse. And I don't know what your relationship is with the character or with the Hellboy world, but I got into it several trades worth of material in. I think like I got into it right when Mignola was stopping doing both the writing and the art chores and starting to farm out the art chores on the reg. And I stuck with pretty much everything that was coming out, except for I was spotty on getting the BPRD book, which featured, like, you know, Hellboy supporting cast in their own title. because you demanded it, you know? And I stopped reading at the end of the Hellboy in Hell series that Mignola did, and have just, I've kept buying the books, but they've just kind of piled up. So I finally have dug in and am working my way through the stuff and trying to catch up and really enjoying it. I knew it was a thing I had to be like in the right state of mind to really get into that world, because, well, let's face it, it's a pretty rich world. Are you familiar with the Hellboy stuff?
I am. I used to read them out of the library. And what I liked about Hellboy, which I think has changed a little bit, but in the old days, I felt like you could read stuff in whatever order, and I would read some BPRD trades. I know there was an overarching or arching story, whatever the correct term is, but I just enjoyed reading random stories about him killing witches or monsters or whatever without any kind of understanding of this came first or that came first or whatever. So I think I missed some of the... I know now there is a progression, but I didn't... wasn't tuned into it. I just enjoyed reading the stories.
Were you reading it out of the library because you were reading the library editions? Well, you know, Hellboy was published not chronologically. The stories bounced around. In fact, the last year or two, they have been publishing new, like, bigger trade paperbacks, publishing the material in chronological order for the first time. And I've been rebuying them because it's kind of fun to have it that way, and it includes all the one-shots and side stories, and they're kind of putting them all in order, which is cool. But there's a rich timeline chronology here. I mean, I have a paperback book that's like the Hellboy timeline just to keep track of, you know, where it all came from and where it's going, because, you know, Mignola taps into all these different mythologies and celestial paradigms, and what he includes and what's canon and what's not could, you know, you could write a book on it.
Yeah, there are some of these classic characters that I just kind of read at random. Usagi Yojimbo's another one that I'm sure has some kind of beginning, middle, and end, but for me, I just read, you know, take a book out of the library and read Grasscutter one time and read some other story, and I feel like the characters and the stories are so well done. While you can enjoy that extra element, you can also just, it's usually a ripping good yarn of the character encountering obstacles and coming over, overcoming them.
Now, you've got Hellboy. He's the star of the Mignolaverse, which is, for those not in the know, Mike Mignola, the writer and artist who started all this stuff and keeps it propped up and going, keeps the train rolling. And his, other than Hellboy, his supporting cast, among them the amphibian-like Abe Sapien and the Firestarter Liz, and, you know, there's other characters, the Professor Brittenholm, or whatever the heck his name is. And at some point, things shifted, and the BPRD book started winding down, and a Abe Sapien solo title started. And that's what I just caught up on, is I read the entire Abe Sapien title. It was 36 issues running from 2013 to 2016. And it was written by Mignola and the usual editor of the Mignola stuff, Scott Ely. And the artists switched off. It was mainly, and interestingly enough, two brothers from Argentina, Sebastian Faimara and Max Faimara. And, well, there were a couple of fill-ins throughout the series that were like one-shot fill-in issues that were flashbacks, but like all the modern stories were all drawn by one or the other, which was kind of cool. And it takes place in the Mignolaverse during the Frog and Ogdru Hem apocalypse that happened at the end of the long-running BPRD series. The BPRD is the Bureau of Paranormal Research and Development, and it is the English government-sponsored organization that found Hellboy and raised Hellboy, and that Hellboy belonged to and sent him on his missions, and was the fulcrum of the series. And what we've got is these Ogdruhem monsters roaming like civilized land, and England was destroyed, and Hellboy died in that battle. Hellboy's dead. He's over. This is when Mignola was doing the Hellboy in Hell series at the same time. So we've got Abe Sapien, who was shot and put in a coma. And when he awoken, he was transformed and less human-like in his features, and even more amphibian and Lovecraftian looking. He's totally transformed.
Oh, wow. And I didn't know he has a new look.
Yeah. Well, by now you're probably used to that look, and you remember, oh, yeah, he used to, like, have a regular nose and lips and a mouth and everything, and now he looks, his face is more like the, almost like the visor, like a big flat plane, like a visor of a motorcycle helmet almost, with features on it. And he's AWOL from the BPRD. He's on the lam because when he was in this coma and was transformed, it's right at the time that everything was going bad with all these monsters popping up and everything, and people think that he might be somehow tied to it and responsible for it, this worldwide apocalypse. So he's on the lam, and he's on this personal mission to get to the Salton Sea. He's kind of drawn there, and he wants to prove that he's not, you know, the cause of all this, these monstrosities and everything. And the BPRD is chasing him, trying to find him, and they want answers too. They fear that he might be the cause of the mutations that are happening, but either way, they want to get their man back. And the first several arcs have Abe like crossing paths with people that he finds along his journey, you know, and dealing with the monsters that mess everything up, or all of a sudden someone turns into one of the monsters, and it's like, oh, was it the proximity to Abe or not? What's going on here? And he also starts to question his very existence, and this is what really drew me into this series. The stories were tied together by Abe's journey, but they weren't, you know, they were more stories about the people who he was encountering and, like, their baggage. And then, you know, Abe kind of, as he passes through, and how he affects their situation. But then we got this underlying thing that was more central to the character. And this was my ticket in to being interested and to read the whole thing, is he starts wondering about his origins. He had found out that he was a Civil War era scientist named Caul, C-A-U-L was the last name, and he discovered, to make a long story short, he discovered an undersea relic and went into a coma, sound familiar, and became transformed, sound familiar, into this amphibious being, Abe Sapien, who then was found years later, decades later, in a abandoned like a test tube type of chamber in an old abandoned under ground lair in Washington DC when the BPRD found him. And he's been like hypnotized, and the other persona has come out, and they've had a conversation with him about how he went and found this relic undersea and all this stuff, and how the transformation happened. And so he's been pretty rock solid. Like, this stone has been overturned. He already has had the, who am I? Why am I unique being in this universe? You know, and he's like come to terms and was comfortable with who he is, but it doesn't seem like he is that guy. Or is there a third personality that's in there too? There's something going on, and he does seem like he's tied to some of the prophecy going along with this whole end of days scenario that's going on. Also, in the middle of the series, Andrew, he hooks up with a group of people who are trying to get from one point to another, and kind of makes their journey part of his journey, and kind of protecting them from the dangers, and the people turn into monsters, and then you get to know them a little bit. And when he gets to the coast, he locks up with a, that's the best way to say it, is like a cult, of people, and you get to know them and kind of what motivates them and all that before everything goes bad. In the final six issues, it all comes to a head with Abe facing a 200-year-old necromancer who wants to control Abe for his own sinister end-of-the-world purposes, because he wants to be Satan's general of his armies, like at the end of the world, that kind of a thing. But at the end of the series, he does learn the incredible truth about his own origins, and it does live up to a Mignola mythological tapestry. Just for a hint, it's anything but him being related to the monsters that are destroying the world. And in the finale, the necromancer guy, Gustav Strobel, transforms himself into an Abe-like being to take Abe's place, like in the prophecy. He becomes the Ichthyosapien for the final showdown, and then it's Abe against a guy who is trying to live up to Abe's potential that he doesn't want to live up to, which, now that I'm saying it, reminds me a lot of the first Hellboy story, right?
I was going to say, doesn't Hellboy fight against his threatened future?
But Andrew, the art's really good in the whole series, and it's got enough of the mystery unraveling about who he is that kept me intrigued, and certainly having it all in front of me, I'm able to jump right into the next issue if I want to, and the arcs are separated quite nicely into little storylines that are two issues, three issues, one issue, and they're all numbered, so you really know what you're getting into each little chapter. It was a very satisfying read, even though, like all the Mignola books, I think he's got great ideas. The art is always good, even when it's not Mignola. He has woven and created this great mythology of characters and stuff in this timeline and his continuity and whatnot. But the storytelling is usually pretty clunky. Like, you don't really know what's going on, and then, you know, Hellboy punches somebody at the end, and that's the end of the story. And I was like, oh, that was... He's a little bit like Richard Sala, who we've talked about many times before, Andrew, in that he really sets a mood and an atmosphere and a feeling when you step into that world and you get all the way into that world, and it's not necessarily about clear sequential storytelling techniques, you know?
No, he started that. There are few creators, I would say, that have created a visual world in as much as the mythology exists, like you point out. But for me, it's those images. I feel like I can, if you show me a page, not just of Mignola, but someone who's doing a Hellboy story, even without Hellboy or them in it, you know it's that he's created a whole genre of, like, that kind of mythical modern horror. Because there are people that ape that style for non-Hellboy stories. So I think it's really an accomplishment over and above the actual world itself, but just how it looks. I feel like he's created this unique thing.
And you're not supposed to know what's going on. Like, there's supposed to be an alien nature to what the characters are encountering, usually, right? These stories aren't action hero stories, per se. And, you know, sometimes he doesn't really find out until the ghost tells you, you know, his tale at the end while they're sitting around the bar or whatever. It's all very shining.
Well, it sounds tempting. Maybe I'll try and read Hellboy in some organized way. Because I also picked up one of the artist editions. Or was it a portfolio? He did some type of thing with IDW. I don't remember if it was a full one or not.
It was an artist edition of the Hellboy in Hell stuff.
Okay.
I got it too.
Yeah.
And it was good.
Yeah, it's just such... So visually striking, the use of the color. It really is. It really, like I said, created this unique thing. And I love that there's Hellboy Day.
And Andrew, mentioning the color, you reminded me that I have done a great disservice to anyone listening by not mentioning the color. The colors on this book is also the completely unassailable Dave Stewart. Great, great colors.
Yeah, just the whole, it's all this wonder. And I think it's great that he's always able to find collaborators that forward that vision. Like, I don't know if I'd want to read a Hellboy done in a totally different style or not.
Well, if you don't mind if I talk your ear off a little bit more about this stuff, the Hellboy books that have been coming out the last, what, like 3 years or so now, are these Hellboy and the BPRD 1950 whatever stories. They're miniseries, and they're all drawn by, each one is drawn by a different artist, and I'm finding it really enjoyable. I mean, there's so much Mignola drawn stuff out there that it's there for you if you want to revisit it, and there's enough of it that you can't remember at all, that it's, there's some of it that you can revisit and be like, oh, this is, feels fresh again. But I find it really charming to see these other artists doing their bit on the Hellboy. So these BPRD books, Hellboy and the BPRD, he was found by Professor Bruttenholm in 1944 in the Mignola-verse, and he doesn't go on his first mission with the BPRD until 1952. That's also the year he gets granted honorary human status by the United Nations. And so now we have this ongoing series of chronological miniseries, Hellboy and the BPRD, written by Mignola and Chris Roberson. And in 2015, they did a one-shot, 1953, The Witch Tree and Rawhead and Bloody Bones, drawn by Ben Steinbeck. That was a one-shot. Then in 2016, they did a 1953 that was three issues, Beyond the Fences, and that was drawn by Paulo Rivera, with inks by Joe Rivera, who I'm thinking is probably kin to him. And that was, like, looking at these different artists, having seen Rivera's stuff was really fun to see his Hellboy. There's also been a two-part 1954 Black Sun with art by Stephen Green. This one was good. It was because it was a couple of issues. It had Hellboy finding a UFO in an Arctic ice field, and he's like, gets in it to check it out, and all of a sudden, like, it closes up and it sinks way down, and it goes into a base that was underneath the Arctic surface. That's like an old abandoned, well, abandoned from being connected to the German government anymore, but it's a fully functioning Nazi, like, base where they're making flying saucers. Nazi flying saucers. I hate Nazi flying saucers.
It's also, I love that they're such the best bad guy, because you can do all kinds of things to them and no one's ever going to be like, oh, yeah, I feel kind of bad for him.
Yeah. Hellboy opens the hatch and sees them and he's like, oh, you guys again, you know. And he's a young Hellboy, so he's a little more crude in some ways and not really wise yet, so to speak. And the last one I read from 2016 was 1954, The Unreasoning Beast, with art by Patrick Reynolds. And The Unreasoning Beast is really a crazy ghost monkey mischief maker thing. That was quite a funny story. But it, they're early tales of Hellboy, good art, short, so you get right in and you get right out. Not a lot of continuity baggage built up yet. And the stories are really almost Conan-like. It's like Hellboy goes out there on some mission and encounters something that's completely out of his realm of understanding or experience up to that point, and in the end he ends up punching it. I'm definitely going to keep going because there's at least three or four more of these series over the last few years, and I'm only up to 2017, so I still got a stack to go through.
Are you reading them in floppy or collected edition?
In floppy. But I, you know me, I'm a floppy buyer who doesn't end up getting to it in time, and then I read them like they're collected editions.
Oh, I have done frequently the same. I just, what I liked about Hellboy also was it seems to come out in a plethora of options. You know, yep. Floppies and different soft covers and hard covers and library editions, and I don't know if they're continuing with those, but I always like when they give you whatever, however you want to read it, they got one for you.
Yeah, the older stuff I had read all in trade, trades. And I really like these omnibuses, trade paperback omnibuses that have been coming out the last couple of years that have been putting them in chronological order. I feel like it's a fresh way to re-experience the material, and the price point is really good on them, especially with the DCBS discount. What have you been reading, though? You must have been reading something or buying something or...
Well, I think I forgot to mention this. I want to go back. I'm pretty sure I haven't covered this yet, but in our world of Kickstarters, and I know the next one of the episodes coming out will mention some already going, but I want to talk about a Kickstarter reward, and that is I'm still on the Trekker train.
Oh.
And Trekker is Ron Randall's futuristic bodyguard, but what's interesting is it's a character that he has to have been working on for some 30 odd years.
Right.
And so what happened was it would appear, she would appear in this title and that title, and then he smartly collected it in this what he calls the Trekker Omnibus. But, and I don't mean to laugh, I have it. It's a nice thing, but it's not omnibus in like the Marvel comic sense of something that weighs 900 pounds and kills you, but it's collects the previous, and then he posts these online so you can just read them as he does them, or you can do like I do and wait for Kickstarter. And his most recent one, he's done, I think, I want to say at least three, but the most recent one was the Dark Star Zephyr, and it's Mercy St. Clair is a bounty hunter set in the future. And there is a ongoing narrative. So in this instance, what's happened is she is on the run. And she is with her lady love, Molly. And Molly used to be a friend. And then they've changed it to a romantic interest. And what's interesting, there are some sort of noir elements about Mercy St. Clair. But it's a weird, when she's happy, it makes me wonder if new readers are going to have the same appeal to that. Because, you know, part of those characters are, their personal lives are always a wreck. And that's how this character was for the first 20-some-odd years of her existence. So I wonder how, so without that context, I wonder if new readers, it's just interesting, the character really has evolved. And it's a different status quo having your character having professionally, she has these, you know, they're on the run, they're trying to dodge, but having, I think most people would take having, you know, being in love and being with the person you love over having a stable job but a wreck of a personal life.
You gotta leave it to Randall, though, because it's his own property. It's not like it's an IP that has to get propped up when unless there's a story to be told, you know what I mean?
Yes.
He could leave it there. The character has evolved to a point where her story is over. But no, so I would give him a shot.
I like it. It just was an interesting idea about, like you say, when you own the character, this is a pretty fundamental shift, I would say, in a genre-type piece. When you're pulling on certain tropes and ideas, you're certainly shifting it now to this other one, and I like that. But it just made me wonder how other people, fresh to it, who wouldn't recognize the backdrop. But anyways, she needs to get off world, and so they hook a ride on the Dark Star Zephyr, and as you can imagine, it doesn't go well. She ends up being, mild spoilers, it doesn't go great, so she ends up being captured and has to work and escape, and she's concerned. Well, she is a super capable fighter, in fact, superiorly capable. Molly, her love, is a singer, so doesn't have the same kind of fighting skills. But needless to say, the characters aren't murdered or anything and survive to give on, and it's left off in such a way that we feel that while they've escaped this, they're still the outstanding people are after them. How are they going to resolve it? Now, I'm not sure, I don't remember the context, but they add an extra story, two stories in. I think, I don't know how, they might have been like bonus options or Kickstarter, what do they call those, stretch goals. I just back these things. I don't really follow them with the kind of rigor that a lot of people do. So they have two little side stories about their mission, one that features a lot of Molly in it, and Mercy has this little fox-like creature who's a pet, Scriff, who is a character in one of them. And yeah, it's just a fun world that he's built all on his own. Ron Randall, very clean artist. You may remember him from Supergirl, I want to say, was probably his biggest title.
Really? He drew Supergirl for a while?
Yeah.
Oh, was it like the white t-shirt Supergirl?
I think it was...
Or the real Supergirl.
The real Supergirl. But that sort of... Oh, go ahead, Darcy.
What I remember him from is because I stopped reading regular comics in 85, 84, 85-ish. 85 it was, and for about almost 5 years. And so what I remember was him starting off on the backup feature, The Cursed Earth, that went throughout a bunch of different DC titles. That was a post-apocalyptic journey kind of a thing with a strong female lead character. But yeah. how is his draftsmanship right now as he's in this time in his career? Are his proportions still look good on his figures and stuff?
Everything
crunched in, or has he still got it?
He still has it. I feel like there's been no drop off in any way. Now, to whatever extent you didn't like him before, you're not going to like him. There's nothing to suggest, but I haven't seen anything that's changed it. And I think this Kickstarter model has really allowed him to work at a reasonable pace. I don't know that he does other work. I think this might be it. And that whole model of like free online and then Kickstarter and then doing shows has been good to him, I would guess. I mean, I bought the omnibus at a show. Might have been the Baltimore show I did with you, Steve. Or it might have been Emerald City the time before then.
I think that's the last time I saw him.
But always, and just a nice man in general. Fun to talk to. But I like that he's found a way, using all these new tools, to keep telling the story he wants to tell. And as you say, I wonder if... I didn't feel like asking if he has an end point in mind. I mean, in some ways, even if you have an end, you can always go back and tell, like, the junior adventures or, you know, that time she, you know, hidden tales, lost tales or whatever. But I am curious how where the wrap-up will come or to what end. And I know he's worked with other people and had her cross over into other properties as well.
I like that Kickstarter's there for the people who are taking advantage of that format and who are publishing things that way, like the Skies of Fire stuff that we've read in the past, and creators like Ron Randall and the Rick Gary little murder mysteries that we've talked about, and Mike Grell of all people has just gotten into the Kickstarter world and is doing a Kickstarter for a new Maggie the Cat story from... Well, actually, it's a reprint of the original two issues of Maggie the Cat that were put out back in the day, and then there's a new story attached to it to, I think, finish that story, and then there's going to be more upcoming and more John Sable and more Shaman's Tears, and he's trying to kick off a little Mike Grell world.
Yeah, and I gave a quick plug to that on Indie Comic Book Noise episode 421.
Good, because they need it.
Yes, and I'm hoping people jumped on that bandwagon, because that would have expired by the... That was expiring on April 21st, so that's gone. But I think at the time it had either just made it or was like... Yeah, that one had just made it, so...
Oh, it's made it, and it's made its first stretch goal, at least, and almost making its second, but because it's their first Kickstarter, it's clunky. It's
yes.
The guys who are doing it have made some rookie mistakes already, and I think the campaign has suffered for it, unfortunately, but it's Mike Grell, so I'm there.
Oh, for sure. John Sable. I mean, I think in that episode I mentioned, I'm pretty sure we talked about those where Maggie the Cat debuted in that title. And we probably covered those issues in our own review of it. So it's fun to see people. Well, you see those people like your Brian Politos. I think he's gets like six-figure returns. You know, if you have the audience and you deliver and you're consistent, this is a fine model. I mean, you're not necessarily going to get that kind of money, but you can make your comics and make it viable.
Dan Brereton, I always get his art books and stuff that he puts out, his nocturnal stuff.
I mean, for new people, I'm a little more wary nowadays. I still back a few new things, but it's hard going unless you do it cheap. And I think I've mentioned this too. The problem is, like, the floppy costs are just through the roof on all of them. They want, like, 10 or 15 and then a couple bucks for shipping, and it's hard to...
Can't do it.
Yeah, I just can't. And I don't...
But then you got to do the digital for those, but then you might not get the stretch goals. Like, I like when the guys do digital stretch goals, too, for digital people. That's always fun.
My problem with digital is I have such a backlog of that stuff that I always fear that I'm just going to get the reward. It's going to get housed away on the hard drive.
Yeah, but I'm not going to pay $20 for a 20-page comic book by a guy who is just trying, you know, is an up-and-comer and has, you know, not a lot of published work under his belt yet, when a comic book by Neil Adams isn't going to cost more than $5 on a newsstand, and that's an inflated, ridiculous high price.
Okay, I don't even... I can't think of the most. I don't think I've gone over $10 for a floppy yet on backing. And that would have to be somebody who I have a lot of goodwill in the bank. It's really more for collected editions, I think, at this point. Or, like you say, if you don't mind going digital. But that is not my idea of...
Who I do still get the singles from and support on all of his campaigns is Joe Picar with his Red Velvet series. That's the pirate series. Joe Picar stuff is so it's titillating, and it's so well colored. I just love his color palette. His flesh tones are just look so warm and inviting.
But yeah, I know you've broken the seal, but I have not jumped into the Patreon waters yet.
I do for like three different artists, Joe Picar actually being one of them, and I also support our friend John Suntress and his Word Balloon podcast via Patreon.
Nice. My concern is, I've noticed in the past when I've done subscriptions, I sometimes forget.
Yeah, but
like months later, I look, I subscribed to this stupid Comic-Con streaming thing. And then I realized, you know, months in, I'm like, I think I've watched one thing.
Yeah. The Patreon thing, what's good about that is, for the most part, you can support creators at just a couple of bucks a month. Like, I really mean a couple of bucks a month, like $2-3, you know, four. I don't think I support anybody at more than $4 a month. So when my Patreon bill comes in, it's like $10, you know, or less. So it's not too bad to forget and not manipulate and just let it go and be supportive of guys.
I appreciate it. It's my personal weakness for letting. I had inadvertently somehow, when I got my tablet, turned on the, not the Wi-Fi, but like its own signal. So for months I didn't notice on my bill that I was paying extra for. So I had to cancel that, and then it's embarrassing because you paid months for some service, and I guess somehow when I was looking for Wi-Fi, I did the wrong thing and connected it, and I literally just used that to read Marvel Unlimited. So,
well, on the creators' side of things, doing Patreon, you also have to think, it's similar to the Kickstarter world where you have to think of what your pledge tiers are. Also, that, like, you have to, you know, I wouldn't be supportive of an artist who's entry-level way of supporting them is, you know, $5 or $10 a month. It is smart for these guys to let you throw a couple of bucks. You know, figure, like I said, if you kind of budget that you're going to contribute $10 to Patreon or $20 to Patreon a month, then you can figure how you're going to divvy that up between people. And creators are smart to create tiers that allow people to get in on viewing content at for just a couple of bucks a month. And that's cool if they do that. Same thing like when you're doing a Kickstarter project. It's like, the first tier that interests me is over $100. That's not cool, you know?
No.
You have to be, and even the Grail guys made that mistake by having too many different variant covers as their tiers between like $25 and $100. And then you have to be pledging at least $50 to qualify for the stretch goals, which were all really awesome. But if there's nothing that you want in that middle ground, then it's like either over $100 or $20 or less. And you need to give some options for people to be able to spend a little more and still get something for it.
Well, particularly with those ones that we have a strong feeling are going to end up getting distributed through other means as well. When you have something that shows significant interest by established creator, you can pretty much guarantee that Image or someone's going to put out a copy sometime later on, and it's going to be a lot cheaper, so you have to make it worth it.
I just finished another series that I really enjoyed, and it was related to going to the Albany Comic Book Show a few weeks ago that we talked about last episode. I said that I had met him years ago at New York City Comic Con Special Edition, I think, the one that they did on the pier there, where everything was moist. So Russ Braun's most recent project has been a 9-issue series with writer Garth Ennis being reunited with the old The Boys team there. But this is through Aftershock Comics, was Jimmy's Bastards. What a fun series, and it just finished up. Did you read any of this, Andrew?
It doesn't ring any bells to me. What company did it get published through?
It's Aftershock.
Okay.
And it was 9 issues. The 9th issue just came out and finished up, wrapped up the series, and it's hilarious, dude. It's filled with the great Russ Braun facial expressions and the protagonist, if you can call him that, has just the perfect pompous jerk face that makes you immediately hate him. It's a riot. It takes a little bit to get off the ground, but it is such a typical Ennis ride, and it captures that The Boys vibe so well while being completely its whole own thing. It has nothing to do with The Boys other than it being this creative team reunited. And what the deal is it is a James Bond-like character. He's the super spy. He's totally Bond. And he has come across his greatest adversary. It is his children. He has, unbeknownst to himself, although he should have known if he was keeping track, that he has accidentally fathered numerous children around the world due to his exploits and his, accomplishments in the bedroom with all the various femme fatales, mostly with crazy names, probably just like in the Bond movies, right? So all his kids are like grown up now, and they have become their own organization that is trying to take him down and get revenge on him and kill him. And so he has to go around and start killing his kids that are trying to kill him. And it's crazy. It's really fun. Nice and bloody and gory and everything you would expect from the Ennis Braun team. It'll make a nice trade.
I do feel like those aftershocks when I saw Marguerite Bennett at the last show I saw her. I just said, even if it's not to my taste, everything they put out seems to be well done. Like, they're not cutting corners or anything. They get good creators and put out a good product.
I've sampled a few of their books, but the only ones that I've really enjoyed has been this one and the Dark Ark book. That's like a Noah's Ark full of all of the demon-like creatures, not the Bambi-like creatures that all went on Noah's Ark.
Yeah. Well, I think I talked about Stronghold, the first issue. I got the second issue with that.
Yeah.
And the new Animosity series. So just fun enjoying some of the world. I don't see it as regular in the store. I mean, I do see issues, but I don't know that the full line is getting carried as much as, say, Image. And I'm still keeping up what Kevin and I call the homework session. Still reading Die, still reading Bitterroot, still on Criminal. So don't worry, fans. Image is still paying the bills.
So, Andrew, before we wrap this episode up, let me tell you about the new Black Hammer book.
You know, Kevin would murder you if you did that without him.
I feel my internet connection going out as I...
He'll sick the Wendigo on you is what he's going to do.
But no, Andrew, this was fun. Just you and I getting together. It's like the old days. It's like the old days of podcasting. Steve and Andrew talking up a storm about comics they're reading.
Yeah, and it's a short episode, too, which is good for Andy the editor. But if you don't have anything else, Steve, I think this is a great place to put a little pin in it.
Got to leave something for next time we talk to those Canadian boys.
Exactly. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Later.
An ancient evil is awakened.
This could be very bad.
And the future of mankind will hang in the balance.
He's got to do something.
We can't. Only Hellboy.
From Mike Mignola and Guillermo del Toro comes the newest chapter in the Hellboy animated series.
Over here, ugly.
We are gods of darkness.
Out of my way! Destiny is overrated.
Hellboy animated.